Greetings from Texas, and welcome to another episode of All Crime, No Cattle, a Texas true crime podcast. I'm Erin, and with us today is our lovely co-host, Shea Butter.
I'm here. Still me. Still buttery and smooth. How you doing, Erin?
I'm pretty good.
Yeah?
How are you?
Man, you're going to find out at the end of this episode how I feel.
Intriguing.
Yeah, the research for this case was weird.
Well, let's start the episode off with our announcement for the fundraiser that we are currently participating in. And this is being handled by True Crime Fan Club. And this is a fundraiser to help raise the money to erect billboards around the Tarrant County area for the missing persons case of Tiffany Johnson. Her missing persons case is related to another missing persons case from a woman named Taliba Islam. So this is a way to kind of tackle both of these cases by having these billboards erected. They're looking for about $2,500 to raise these billboards. They're currently right now at about a third of that. So they really need the funds to be able to do this. And this is something that we're really excited to participate in. So if you go to our link, or if you search the GoFundMe website for Tiffany Johnson, you can go there, donate $30 or more, and you'll be entered into a raffle to win a bunch of merch from us, Gone Cold, True Crime Fan Club, Court Junkie, Generation Y, a bunch of really amazing podcasts out there, and you'll be set. So all you have to do is take a screenshot of your donation, send that over to tcfcpod@gmail.com, and you will be entered into the raffle. And again, this is something that's really important, so we're really hoping that we get them to their end goal, which is, again, $2,500. It's going to be wrapping up at the beginning of October, so we don't have that much time. So if you can go ahead and do that right now, that would be really excellent and for a amazing cause.
Yeah, definitely. I'm super happy that it benefits a case from this area and that we get to be involved with a fundraiser with such big shows like Generation Y.
Yeah, I know. Hi, Erin and Justin.
Hey, Generation Y, are you hanging out with us? Okay, well, if that's all of our updates, I'm ready to move on to episode number 32. You know, the last couple of weeks, we've brought you some hard-hitting true crime. We've brought you some interesting legal cases and how they panned out in court. Some really interesting forensic details from crime scenes. Well, we need to shift gears a little bit, like always. We try and keep it fresh on the show. And it calls for kind of a weird, wild ride of a case. And who better to host a weird case than me? I've done a bunch of them so far. I feel like that's what I bring to the show. So here it is, in all of its glory. So I wanted to start things off by saying, I don't want this to be an ode to the criminal in this case. You know our show. We typically pay homage and focus on the victims as much as we can. And we really feel like they're the most important and we want to do them as much justice as possible on this show. Well, in this case, a lot of the victims haven't spoken out. And a lot of the family members of the victims haven't spoken out. There are a couple and we're going to focus on those. But that's the only way we're actually going to understand the case. So today, I have this really bizarre case to discuss with you. This is a quasi-known case that some of you may be a little familiar with. This is most likely due to some of the lore attached to the details, as well as some false implications surrounding a particular film which came out in the same decade. In this story, we will be taking a few twists and turns that will most likely lead us into topics involving such things as history of the Texas legal system, human dismemberment, gun obsession, animal mutilation, mental health issues, the death penalty, the media's role in crime news, and even extradition proceedings. It's a lot to cover, but we're going to try and do it all today.
Sounds like a wild ride.
Yeah. So I hope that you're prepared. I hope that you're ready to strap in for this wild and bumpy trail that we're headed down as I lay out for you the life and crimes of one Robert Elmer Cleason. So, first off, like we always do, we want to hit up our sources. We feel that's very important. So the first source that we ended up using today is the Texas Monthly, a series of articles from 1975 by Richard West. The second is the New York Daily News, and this is an article that was written in 2016 that pretty much kind of outlines the entire case, and that was written by Mara Boveson. We also used the documentary, The Real Texas Chainsaw Massacre, that came out in 2003.
Oh, I feel like we have a little hint of the film that you're talking
about. We also used the Deseret News, And the Deseret News is out of Utah, and it's a Mormon publication, and this article was written by Pat Reavy. We used several articles from the BBC by numerous authors. We also used clippings found from newspaper.com, and those are all articles from different publications around Texas, small local papers from 1975. And we used an article from mormonstoday.com that was put out in 2001. That was by Ken Larson. All right, so let's get into it. Let me take you back in time, Aaron. I'm going to take you back to September 20th. It's your birthday.
I know. I got so excited. Yeah. You guys, my birthday is coming up, and apparently something important happens on my birthday in this case.
I don't know if you're going to like it.
Oh.
But it's in 1934.
That's quite a few years before I was born. I'm not quite that old.
And it's in Buffalo, New York. This was the day that Robert Elmer Cleason was born.
No, I share my birthday with this guy.
Yeah, you share your birthday with the Cleese.
Oh, I feel sick.
Well, I told you to strap in, get ready. This is our first bump on the trail.
Oh, no.
Robert Cleason's father was a simple store clerk, and his mother was a stay-at-home mom that just kind of took care of the family and the home. The young Robert Cleason enjoyed little else besides hunting and target shooting with his father. Side note here, I found several references to Robert Cleason's father and his mental illnesses, and this was cited in multiple sources, but they never actually put down the specific diagnosis. We just know he had mental issues.
He might not have ever been actually diagnosed.
Yeah.
I mean, back then.
Sure, it was the 30s and 40s.
Yeah.
But I want you to keep this in mind because there's not much known about Robert Cleason's early years, save for a few strange incidents that we are going to cover. I want to kind of put this into your mind and get you to think about it as we go through the case. We do know from a series of medical documents, interviews, and other proceedings that were conducted with Robert's close friends and family that it was discovered he had a habit of killing animals, dismembering them, and playing with their remains. I know. Starting off the show with animal dismemberment. Hang in there, guys. It only gets worse. Another strange story in Robert Cleason's youth is when he accidentally stepped on a rusty nail when he was just 18 years old. His mother freaked out and took him to the local hospital, but while sitting in the waiting room, Robert became furious, and he unleashed this aggressive outburst on everyone who was in the waiting room. He punched his mother in the face. He went out to their car, retrieved a pistol, and re-entered the waiting room where he began to discharge his weapon. Thankfully, no one was injured or hit by any of the rounds. However, due to this, Cleason was sentenced to serve 2 years in a psychiatric facility. That's a really weird outburst, right?
Does anybody know what set him off?
Not really, and that's why he really couldn't explain himself. He kept saying he got upset, and that's how he chose to deal with it. So they're like, well, you're going to the mental institution.
Okay.
He served his time at the psychiatric facility. Doctors there said that he was polite, he was friendly, and he loved animals.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, when he was released in 1952, the next phase of Robert Cleason's life began. He actually did quite a few things over the next two decades. To start, he moved all around New York, all over upstate New York. He worked odd jobs and he traveled. He picked up some skills along the way. He completed a mail order course in taxidermy and continued his passion for hunting and guns.
I'm fine with the taxidermy part. I'm not fine with the...
Knowing who he is already?
Yeah, knowing that he enjoys killing things as much as he seems to.
Yeah. Well, Cleason, he even got married at one point in 1960 and had a daughter. Because she doesn't want her name out or her daughter's name out there, I've left them out. But after 5 years of marriage, he reported, quote, my wife disappeared and ran off with my child. Cleason later claimed to his friends and family, his divorce from his first wife was on, quote, grounds of desertion.
Do we know what actually happened with her?
Kind of. She changed her name, she fled across the country, and she kind of stayed in hiding for a long time and has never really talked about what happened.
Okay.
But we can assume something bad happened.
Oh, man. Good for her for getting out of there.
This is where we begin to see the quote-unquote real Robert Cleason start to emerge. You see, Robert, he might have some severe mental health issues going on at this time. However, he was very cunning, charming, highly intelligent, and most of all, He could spin a yarn and twist a tale and put a little shift on things to make him seem like the good guy.
We've all known people like this.
I mean, for sure, right? Cleason also started telling everyone he met these crazy far-fetched myths and legends about, who else, himself. I don't have time to go into all the wild tales that Cleason would tell on a regular basis, but would you like to have some of the highlights, per se?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. At one point or another, Cleason claimed the following. He was a former CIA agent.
Of course!
An assassin.
Oh my god.
A spy. A decorated Air Force pilot. That he held several PhDs. Spoke a dozen languages. Was, in fact, an Olympic athlete.
What?
Yes. A famous big game hunter. A celebrated author. And a consultant on weapons, ballistics, and survival to the military.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. What a complete psychopath.
I know, right? And I'm not making any of that up. That is straight from the mouth of Cleason and from people who knew him. We now know none of these claims were true, but that the truth was Robert Cleason was a monster. In 1962, somehow Cleason talked his way into a job as a small-town deputy. Surely his charisma and ability to embellish stories, in conjunction with any of those things he mentioned before, was able to win over this local sheriff's office. But his service only lasted 2 years, when his supervisors soon decided that he was unstable for the job.
Okay, so we're still in New York right now.
Mm-hmm. Almost 10 years later, in 1971, Cleason earned a bachelor's degree. Do you want to guess what it was in, Aaron?
Creative writing?
That's what it should have been, most likely. Man, he would have been such a better author. There's so many, like, crazy narcissistic authors that are good writers.
Yeah.
He definitely knows how to tell a tale. No, it was in our favorite subject, sociology and anthropology.
No.
Yep.
Oh, no. I have way too many parallels with this guy.
Yeah, you do. You love to play with bones, and you love anthropology. Also, you share the same birthday.
Oh, no, I hate him.
And he also minored in education, and he got certified to teach history at the high school level. His teaching hopes were dashed and cut short, though, when he reportedly shot off a man's toe after a dispute, and his teaching license was revoked.
That's all that happened to him?
That's not all that happened to him, because charges were definitely brought up. Cleason landed in jail, but he posted bond and quickly skipped out of town, fleeing the charges.
Man, times were different back then.
I know, right? Like, you could go from town to town, be a vagabond, say whatever you wanted about who you were and what you did, and people just, like, awarded you things, and then if you screwed up, you could just leave.
Yeah.
And do it all over again.
Yeah, just restart. Nobody can track you down.
Yep. Well, at this point, Cleason decided it was time to head south. To escape the heat of his charges, he was headed for a new life and a new surrounding in Austin, Texas, Aaron.
Oh, wow. So he literally went across the country.
Yep, in just a few months. Once he arrived in Austin, Robert Cleason befriended several members of the local Mormon temple. He converted to Mormonism and arranged to stay in a mobile trailer on a plot of land just out of eyesight from a taxidermy business that was operated by some of the local Mormon congregation.
That's weird. I didn't know Mormons were into taxidermy.
Well, they're into hunting and, like, survival and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah, I guess that's true. I can see that. Question.
Sure.
Did he ever express being religious before this point, or was this his first foray into organized religion?
This is really the first time we see evidence of him or his family or anyone who knew him up until this point of him really getting into religion and just turning a new leaf. And he even got baptized in the Mormon church.
Okay. So he's at least putting on this air of, I've changed my ways.
Sure.
I'm becoming a better person or something like that.
And he didn't have a job and he didn't have anywhere to stay. So these people are putting him up since he seems really interested in the Book of Mormon and their teachings and stuff. And so during the day, Cleason would come into this taxidermy shop. He'd talk to the staff, the customers. He assisted in performing taxidermy work, and then he would retire to his trailer out on the back property. Or so they thought. The truth.
That was, oh God, I like, oh no, what happens? I'm like at the edge of my seat.
Well, you should be, because the truth of Cleason's free time would later be revealed in letters to a prospective girlfriend named Linda Miller, who lived just a few towns over. In these letters, Cleason detailed how he had keys to everything on the property, and the landowner trusted him. He trusted him with the taxidermy shop, the equipment, even until he would arrive at 7:30 a.m. He thought if anything happened, Robert's going to take care of it. I don't think he thought that Robert would be messing around in the taxidermy shop all by himself, doing whatever he just put his mind to.
I'm nervous.
Yeah. Well, in other letters to Linda, he wrote about his loneliness and how he really needed a companion, and he could make a really good match for her and support her because, you know, he's a great hunter, he shoots deer on the property, he eats steak almost every night, and of course, you know, his tall tale escapades go on from there. He talked about how good of a marksman he was, his career as an assassin, his degrees.
He mentions that in his love letters?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, God, this guy.
Actually, one of the true things that Robert says in a lot of these letters and a lot of his reports is how good of a crack shot that he was. That's actually true. He was a very good shot. He loved guns, and one of the other things that he loved to do was to amass an enormous gun collection. He was a huge gun collector, and he joined all of these gun clubs and tournament shooting competition groups. They would go out and compete in shooting competitions, basically. He also joined a bunch of hunting groups with other guys, and they would go hunt together. They would actually, like, try and bag the largest deer, stuff like that. All seems fine, right? That part,
I mean,
least.
I don't love it, but it's...
Seems normal.
It's normal, yeah.
Well, he also made friends in a group of men that enjoyed an illegal version of these hobbies. And that's poaching.
Oh.
In December of 1973, Cleason was arrested for what else but rustling bison was the charge.
Wow.
Yeah.
What is this, 1783?
Well, they use trucks instead of horses at this point. But yeah, it's sneaking onto somebody's property and illegally killing bison and hauling them off in your truck. He became very angry with his local Church of Jesus Christ Latter-day Saints because they didn't send a lawyer to get him out of jail. To his point, though, this was sometimes a practice that they would offer some of their members of the LDS chapter just because, you know, they're trying to protect their own. They're trying to offer them services, that kind of thing. Well, they weren't helping Robert Cleason out. And after 5 months in jail, Cleason was released and members of Cleason's LDS church became increasingly uneasy with his developing behavior. A member of the church, who studied with Cleason from time to time, remarked that on a particular home study visit, Cleason, quote, erupted into an absolute rage, unquote. This particular missionary remarked how quickly Robert could go from calm and quiet to a volatile man ready to lash out with anger and violence. Friends and fellow churchgoers who visited Cleason during this period always noted two things. He was a hoarder of guns and ammunition. It was everywhere in his trailer and on the property. Also, he loved to target shoot with friends. If you weren't into target shooting, boy, he'd make you into target shooting when you came over. He liked to cook meals, and then they'd go out and you'd shoot targets out in his makeshift shooting range. Which, again, is fine. The only problem was, once he was done shooting, he would send his visitors and friends downrange to retrieve the targets. As they returned with the evidence of his skill, they would look up in the direction of Robert to find him training a pistol or one of his favorite sniper rifles at them. Yeah. Very menacing, right?
Like he's doing this as a joke?
Yeah,
or...
not cool. After a few terrifying moments of holding them at bay at gunpoint, Cleason would lower the rifle and would laugh maniacally at his friend's terror.
That is not fun. I would not go back.
Not cool, dude.
No.
Friends of Cleason also learned of his most recent second failed marriage. His wife reportedly sent letters to members of the congregation, and in those letters, she explained how she filed for divorce papers after finding Cleason bathing in a bathtub with a disemboweled deer that he had killed.
What?
She left, and she went straight to the courthouse, filed for divorce.
What do you mean he was bathing with a dismembered deer?
She said he was naked, in the tub, with blood and the carcass of a disemboweled deer, playing with it.
What the hell?
Okay, yeah, have we hit enough bumps yet so far on this trail?
Yes, this person is, I don't even know, very unstable, unsettled.
All those things.
Unsettling, that's for sure. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, I mean, that'll do it. If I ever saw you in a tub with a dead animal, I am gone.
I wouldn't blame you, dude. That's some weird stuff.
That's incredibly frightening.
So you can see how this kept making the congregation feel really weird about Cleason. And he continued to become increasingly more hostile during those short weeks. And he got more and more agitated as those charges were about to come up and he was going to have to go to trial. What does Cleason do? He begins writing a series of threatening letters to the local Mormon bishop. Here's an excerpt from one of them. Quote, "Dear Brother Blair, I am sick of not doing much. I will not mess about any longer. I am going for the kill. I gave up everything I owned and was chased, hounded, tracked down, jailed, starved, and insulted, not only by my enemies, but by the church itself. I do not want a pat on the head or a paw shake. I want blood. I want to go after my false accusers now and bring them to dishonor. I'm coming for their heads."
What the fuck, man? Did you mean to say paw shake?
He said paw shake. I don't know what a paw shake is, but that's what he wrote.
That's weird. This is all very disconcerting.
Oh, definitely. At this point, after receiving these threatening letters, the bishop orders all prayer visits and study groups from the church to Cleason's home to be stopped immediately.
Sure. Sounds pretty responsible.
Now, at this juncture, Aaron, this is like your last chance to tell me, where do you think this is going? Just based on your impressions. Because it's about to get serious.
Well, I'm picturing Leatherface, Texas Chainsaw Massacre. So I'm picturing his trailer that he's living in to be like the set for that movie. So hooks and chains and weird animal parts everywhere and him just living in utter filth in this little like secret trailer he has where he does all his creepy things.
Yeah, like flesh masks hanging on the walls and stuff.
Yes. So that's one thing. But I'm imagining he's not going to take this whole "I've been dissed by my community" lightly. And can only imagine that something is going to happen with these people who used to be parts of his church.
Well, you're on the right track with one of those. So after the threatening letters and the bishop telling everybody to stop going over to his house. So there are two Mormon missionaries, Gary Darley and Mark Fisher. They're 20 years old and 19 years old. And they had been routinely going over to Cleason's trailer. Well, on October 28th, 1974, for reasons of their own, Gary Darley and Mark Fisher decided to not break their usual Monday night visit at Cleason's trailer for religious study and dinner. We can imagine that this evening went like a typical one. Probably, you know, let Cleason get some ranting off of his chest about the church. And he probably told him some fake war stories about all the various wars that he was in and had intimate knowledge of. And maybe some target practice. That night in 1974 was the last time Gary or Mark were ever seen alive again. Obviously, friends and family figure out pretty quickly that the boys are missing. And they put out a missing persons report. They tell the police that last time they knew about, they were supposed to be headed over to Cleason's trailer for a study session. Police had strong suspicions that Cleason had in fact killed the two men after questioning him and several members of the church, but they didn't have enough to get a search warrant for the trailer. So that's when the police start trying to think outside of the box. Well, after delving into Cleason's record of obsessive gun collecting, they found an illegal bill of sale for a rifle. That was enough to file for a search warrant and gain access to his trailer. In addition to weapons, pornography, and tons of photo IDs, investigators found a watch with blood on the band, apartment keys, and a bullet-punctured name tag. The last three were identified by relatives as belonging to Mark Fisher. They also found a curious large amount of manuscripts, and these were all authored by various names that Cleason used as aliases. And this wasn't figured out immediately. It kind of took them some time to figure this out. But one of them in particular was a discourse on dismembering animal carcasses and their disposal. The one thing investigators did not find in the trailer, Aaron, is what you so wonderfully described to us, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre scene. It was very neat. It was organized. There were nice stacks of books everywhere. There wasn't copious amounts of blood and the face masks and flesh hanging from the ceiling. There weren't any bodies either. And that was the weird thing. Mm-hmm. Where were Mark and Gary?
Yeah.
And, you know, initially, Robert Cleason, he defended himself and said that, well, you know, sometimes we like to wrestle, we like to roughhouse when the boys come over, and I scratched one of them and broke his watch. I was going to get fixed for him.
How old is Robert Gleason at this point?
It's 1974. He's 40 years old.
Okay. A 40-year-old man wrestling with two 20-year-old boys, you should be arrested anyway.
And, you know, then there's the question of the name tag from the church that has the bullet hole through it.
Yeah.
And he said, well, you know, I'm a crack shot and I like to do some gun artistry sometimes when people come over and I do tricks. So I pulled his badge off and I threw it in the air and I shot it.
So he has a response to everything, an answer for everything. Okay.
And, you know, I bring up the alias thing with all the false IDs and the alias that he used to write the manuscript because there's an interesting catch here.
So these false IDs are his false IDs.
They're from people that he's created and that he's made up. And he's made whole histories of these people and like things that they did, military records and like awards that they got and all kinds of stuff.
Wow.
One of the prevailing alias names that he used was Richard Radd, spelled R-A-A-D-T. I bring this up because investigators and psychologists who have examined this case believe this alias of Richard Radd to be a split personality of Robert Gleason. And Richard Radd is one of the latest creations of Robert Gleason. He kind of embodies this persona that Gleason has been building over these years and all these tall tales of an ex-CIA assassin, the decorated war hero that was falsely discredited during the Nixon era, the lies of Richard Radd's very existence had slowly been eating their way into the mind of Robert Gleason for decades. It's like a slow culmination until the point where he's believing all of these lies that he's been saying, and he believes he's Richard Radd in hiding from the CIA, and that Robert Gleason is just a fake name he's given himself so that he can evade authorities and Big Brother government.
That is odd.
Well, investigators immediately started to focus further on Gleason as the prime suspect after starting to piece some of these things together. They also began to wonder about Gleason's mental health history and how it pertained to the two missing Mormon missionaries. They found out about his mental institution stint, about how he went into a hospital and shot the waiting room up. And after examining all the evidence from the trailer, Austin police arrested Gleason as he exited a prayer service at the Mormon church.
Wow, so he's still going to church after all this, huh?
Yep. Gleason told investigators that Gary and Mark had never arrived at his trailer, and next he told this tall tale of Mormon conspiracy against him, and that the boys were likely still alive somewhere, and that the church just had him in hiding to get him, you know, shuffled off and put in prison. Investigators, like you and I, were not convinced. So in 1975, the case against Robert Elmer Gleason and the murder of Mark Fisher began. The prosecution focused on Gleason's documented mental instability, the fact that he was the last person to have possibly seen the two missionaries, and a mountain of circumstantial evidence.
So he's only being put on trial for the murder of one of these young men.
Yep, and we're going to talk about that here in a little bit.
Okay.
The prosecution also laid out their theory of how the evening's events took place. The dinner, an angry conversation, and then retiring outside for some target shooting. The reason why they think that is the following. Remember those stories about how he would sight down friends retrieving his targets and terrify them? Imagine two Mormon missionaries going down the range to retrieve Cleason's targets while he reloaded his favorite sniper rifle. It's important to point out that Mark Fisher's bloody name tag with the bullet hole was found in the area where Gleason typically stood when practicing his shooting. Next, the prosecution had to deal with the lack of bodies. What happened to Mark and Gary? After fully searching Cleason's travel trailer, another warrant was procured and they searched the nearby taxidermy shop. At the trial, they released their findings. Inside, forensic technicians discovered a bandsaw that was used to cut up unneeded animal parts. On the blade of this bandsaw, they found what appeared to be human hair. After comparative analysis, the hair follicles were found to match those of Mark Fisher. The prosecution theorized Robert Gleason not only murdered these two men in cold blood, but cut up their bodies, as well as their skulls, on that shop's bandsaw. This was most likely done to hide the remains among the shop's tankerage pile. This is where the shop staff would typically toss animal remains that are not needed for a mounting. You know, you need just need the head of a deer to do a mounting. And what do you do with the rest of the body? You cut it up, you dismember it, and you put it in this tankerage pile for sanitation people to come by, pick it up, and they actually take it off to be turned into fertilizer.
So that's where they think the bodies went.
That's where the prosecution think they went.
Oh, man.
Near the end of the trial, the district attorney held up the previously mentioned manuscript on dismemberment and body disposal of animals. He read from it to the jury and finished by saying, quote, "This is what happened to those two men. This is why there are no bodies in this case." That's all I want to read from his manifesto work. There's a lot of it. And if you want to go read some really dark, weird stuff that kind of tells you more about how Robert Gleason thinks, by all means, go read it. I love a good manifesto because there's nothing like hearing the ramp up words of someone right before they're about to do something horrible. And like, it almost feels like you're somehow able to hear how they're thinking at that time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've had manifestos on the show before, and they're always very interesting. I would say, if you know somebody, especially if they are a gun nut like this guy, like Charles Whitman, and they spend a lot of their time alone writing,
like with a typewriter,
tapping away, yeah. Run. Because that person is not to be trusted. Anybody who spends their free time writing manifestos of how the world has wronged them, something bad's about to happen there.
Well, the jury definitely agreed with you, Aaron. It didn't take the jury of Texans long to deliver a verdict. They were done in less than an hour. And on June 3rd in 1975, Robert Gleason was found guilty of capital murder in the case of Mark Fisher and sentenced to death. Side note, no one has ever been charged in the murder of Gary Darley. This is most likely due to the lack of physical evidence as far as his remains are concerned.
So with Mark, we had his name tag and the watch.
Yeah.
And then perhaps the human hair they thought was Mark's as well. Yeah. So we have a lot more physical evidence that they believed was tied to Mark than Gary.
You could make a much better case for Mark with the physical evidence. And
that's sad.
I know, right? I also want to talk about how the media immediately found a nickname for this case. The use of the infamous bandsaw in the taxidermy shop, along with the recent release of the film Texas Chainsaw Massacre, forever cemented Robert Elmer Gleason as the, quote, "Texas Chainsaw Killer." Due to this, Gleason has since been inaccurately cited as an inspiration for the film. The film was actually, like I said, released before Gleason even got to Texas.
Oh, really?
It was weeks before he even arrived that it came out. And it's unknown if he's even ever seen the movie. And, you know, horror buffs like us, we know Ed Gein is the real inspiration of Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Mm-hmm.
But, man, if you hear people talk about this case, they will misquote that all the time. And he didn't even use a chainsaw.
That is interesting, though. Yeah, there are some similarities there. And then we just had a case, I think your previous case, where one of the people who was on the movie became a lawyer and then prosecuted a case that you were covering. So that's interesting.
Yeah, he was a grip on Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah.
Well, after the trial, for the next 3 years, Robert Gleason sat on death row awaiting his execution. As the date of his death sentence approached, the media once more whipped up into a frenzy, preparing for the notorious Texas Chainsaw Killer to receive his final punishment. Gleason, in the meantime, gave several interviews with the media regarding his innocence and wrongful conviction. He took plenty of time out of his day to meet with media and talk to them about, like, oh, if you just got to know me, you'd know that that's not the person that I am.
Oh, sure. I can tell. Yeah, I can definitely tell that this guy's a talker.
Mm-hmm.
Because he thinks he's smarter and better than everybody else. And if he can only tell you the true story behind everything, you're going to believe him.
Yeah, that's his skill. He can spin a yarn.
Yeah.
So with his last appeal, as time is running out for Gleason, a legal technicality was discovered.
Uh-oh.
The original search warrant used to search Gleason's trailer was called into question. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals deemed there was a defect in this search warrant. Not just that, but any evidence found as a result of that search warrant was deemed to be invalid and must be thrown out.
So this was the search warrant about the illegal bill of sale for a firearm?
Yes, that is correct.
So what was wrong with that search warrant based on that illegal bill of sale?
There were technicalities in the form when applying for the warrant that were deemed to make the warrant invalid and inadmissible.
Oh my God. You're kidding me.
So in November of 1977, there was a full reversal of the conviction ruling. And they determined Gleason was to either be retried or released. That meant that Cleason could face a retrial without the evidence of the blood, the watch, the name tag, and all of his manifestos and manuscripts.
Yeah, you've got a big fat nothing.
It all becomes circumstantial at that point. You still have everything from the taxidermy shop because that's a separate warrant, though. Also, keep in mind what was going on in the legal world at this time, Aaron, especially in Texas. It's the late 70s.
The whole like reconfiguring of the death penalty.
Yes. So the U.S. Supreme Court determined that the current death penalty legislation in states and on a national level to be cruel and unusual punishment. And there's this whole chaos that ensues at the state level where they're trying to figure out, well, what are we going to do without the death penalty now? What are we going to do about prison overpopulation? If you want to hear more about this stuff, we covered this whole topic in the Broomstick Killer episodes, and also in the Texas 7 episodes to some degree. We did a whole 4-part series on the Texas legal system and its history, but that's basically another factor that you have to consider in this case when prosecutors are like, okay, do we want to retry this case?
Without all this evidence.
Yeah, because he could just walk free.
Mm-hmm.
The other key point here is that the search warrant of the taxidermy shop was still valid. However, DNA evidence had not yet become the amazing tool that we know today. It was basically comparative hair follicle analysis and blood work. That was it. So again, it's not a smoking gun in this case.
No.
And also, I'm going to point out, if you do have a time traveling device in the future, like if there's some archaeological dig and you find the hard drive that has these episodes on it and you listen to it and time travel's a thing at this time, don't do it. Don't time travel. And if you do, you damn sure better not come back to the 60s and 70s in Texas, because you're going to die. Like, there's just terrible, terrible serial killers and murder, and everything's unsafe.
I mean, I think that was across the nation.
Yeah, but I'm speaking from our neck of the woods.
Our perspective.
Yeah. Well, anyways, with evidence from the trailer eliminated and uncertainty in the legal world on capital punishment, a conviction seemed unlikely. Prosecutors did not pursue a second trial, and instead they hoped other lesser convictions of illegal firearms and the previously untried case where Cleason shot a man's toe off and fled his trial, they felt that that would land him in prison for enough time to where they could build a substantial case against him and retry this case at another date.
Okay.
Overall, Cleason was sentenced to serve 9 years in prison.
But he's already served 3 years, right? So does he get time served for that?
No, this is a whole new sentencing because it's a resentencing under new circumstances with new trial.
So 9 additional years. Yeah. Okay.
Honestly, it seems like Texas prosecutors and legal experts just kind of forgot about Cleason while he was serving this time, because much like in the case of Kenneth Allen McDuff, they may have had too much on their plates with constant prison reform, violent criminal releases, and the other chaos of the current legal climate that's just making their lives hell as prosecutors. Robert Cleason used this to his advantage, though, and he behaved himself in prison. He bided his time. Oh, and there's another thing he did. He wrote a ton of letters to people. Cleason began signing up for several pen pal services. Of course, he spun his lies to anyone who would listen and write back or subscribe to his profile in the catalog or the mailing list that he was given. One of those people who began receiving letters from Cleason was a UK woman in her late 50s named Marie Longley. After Marie's husband passed away, she joined an organization called the International Pen Friends Club in Dublin, Ireland. They wrote to each other quite often and developed what she referred to as, quote, a blossoming friendship. Cleason explained the return address of the prison by lying to Marie in one of the letters, telling her he was a college professor who volunteered his time to teach classes to inmates there, and this was simply the address to his office at the prison.
Oh my God.
Can you see how this guy tells a tale?
I mean, it seems pretty out there, though. Why would your mailing address be your office at the prison?
But see, with his twist of he's a professor and, you know, he cares about these prisoners.
Yeah, and he's well-written and well-spoken, and he sounds very intelligent.
Mm-hmm. All this is going on with Marie over in the UK with these letters. Back in the States in 1988, Cleason's parole hearing comes up. And he was awarded with a release from prison and a 2-year parole period.
Wow.
Yeah, he walked out of the prison and he attempted to restart his life over again back home in Buffalo, New York. Well, unfortunately for Robert Cleason, it was sweeps week in the United States. I don't know if you know about sweeps week, but that's where everybody's trying to get their ratings up to renew shows and make sure you get raises and show that, hey, we're doing a good job. There wasn't a whole lot else going on in the news besides the release of the real Texas Chainsaw Killer and that he was settling down in Buffalo, New York.
Oh.
So he quickly found himself in the American news cycle and this huge spotlight. Every town in and around Buffalo, New York was quickly finding out one week or the next that the Texas Chainsaw Killer was preparing to move in next door. Once the news would spread to residents, they would start small riots, and they would erupt with petitions and town hall meetings regarding the safety of the neighborhood. They were not having this dude living in Buffalo, New York. Which, hey, I don't blame him, right?
No.
Well, while his story was covered extensively here in the United States, abroad, the case wasn't a blip on the radar. He was able to remodel himself through the lens of another alternative personality to Marie Longley. Cleason thus began planning to relocate to the UK once his parole in the US was complete. And this will start Act Two.
Hey, ACNC Posse. Isn't it crazy how much we pay for new brand name clothes? Wouldn't it be great if there was a place to discover awesome discounts on gently used clothes right from the comfort of your home? Well, there is. It's swap.com. The world's largest online consignment and thrift store. Stop driving to store after store and sifting through racks. Easily sift through millions of clothes in seconds on swap.com with easy-to-use filters to find just what you need. With swap.com, you can save up to 90% off retail price on your favorite brands like Lululemon, Carter's, Nike, J.Crew, Gap, and more. Quality, hand-inspected items are added to daily, and you can find new deals every day on swap.com's homepage. And if something doesn't fit, you can enjoy hassle-free returns within 30 days. As a special offer for our listeners, get 35% off select items on your first order with promo code TEXAS. That's 35% off select items for your first order with promo code TEXAS. Hurry up and check out swap.com today.
So in 1990, after receiving his passport, yes, Robert Cleason applied and was given a passport.
What?
Yeah.
Huh. Is he still on parole?
No, he just completed his parole.
Oh, okay.
But like he had it all set up so that he could get his passport right after his parole was over and head off to jolly old England.
Yeah. Wow.
So after he gets his passport, Cleason traveled to Barton upon Humber. I'm not sure if I'm saying that right, but Barton upon Humber is how like they say it. They say it like really fast. They're like, oh, it's Barton upon Humber. Like super quick. So I don't know. Barton upon Humber is how it's written. And it's in Lincolnshire in the northeast of England.
Okay.
Well, Interpol, who should have done a thorough background check on Cleason when he travels to another country, missed important checks on Cleason's background and prior convictions thanks to his crafty skills at falsifying documents regarding his passport.
Cool.
Previously, he wrote Marie Longley and said he would be coming to visit for a holiday and they would have a wonderful few weeks together. Well, after a lengthy stay, over a couple of months, the two decided they should get married, and he should stay there for the rest of their lives.
Oh, Marie. Oh, honey.
Yeah. Bad move, Marie. At first, Cleason settled in nicely. They were a loving couple, and, you know, he got along with everybody in Barton upon Humber. He became friends with local gun clubs, just like he had been in the United States, and hunting groups that, where have we heard this before, right? But one of the other groups that he became really close with was the local authorities. This is really like a smart move for him. He becomes one of their favorite people because he's like basically a war hero who's come over to Europe. And,
well,
you know,
he stylized himself.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
Like his new persona is a war hero. And he, again, he's taking on Richard Rad's past. And like he keeps going back to those manuscripts and those stories that he had written down. And they think that this guy should have parades in town and like everybody should bow down to this guy, basically.
Barf.
Well, one of the other things that Cleason brought along with him to the UK, besides his lies, were several medals that he loved to show off. He claimed to have been awarded a Purple Heart and a Congressional Medal of Honor, and according to him, he received them directly from the then-president, Dwight Eisenhower, himself.
What What a garbage person. I mean, obviously he's a garbage person, but he's faking earning a Purple Heart. Come on, dude.
And the highest honor that you can receive, the Congressional Medal of Honor.
Yeah. What war was he saying that he participated in?
All of them.
Oh, all of the wars.
It just depended on, like, which person that he was talking to at the time, like, what he said. It could have been Korea. It could have been World War II. It could have been Vietnam.
Yeah.
You know, if it was in the CIA, he went all over the world and he spoke a dozen languages.
Sure.
While impressed with his resume, the local authorities even let Cleason become a ballistics and firearms advisor for their department.
Yes, it's very Edmund Kemper of him to kind of get ingratiated into the local law enforcement community.
Yeah, remember he tried to be a deputy for a while and keep your friends close and your enemies closer, right?
Sure. Plus, I mean, it makes men like that who have all of these issues with power and authority, they love rubbing elbows with people like that and trying to feel like they're on their level.
Definitely. Well, Cleason also began his interests in acquiring guns once again. Shockingly, he was issued an official firearms dealing license by the local magistrate. Apparently, at this time, it was extremely uncommon to check the background of foreign nationals during the application process for such a license.
Because the assumption is that their background has already been checked, and that's how they got their passport.
Yeah, I mean, if Interpol's given them the go, they got their visa, they got their passport.
So annoying.
I know. And I'll remind you that famously, it's much more difficult to acquire firearms in the UK than it is in the US.
Yeah.
And they have very strict standards for even owning a gun for hunting or recreation. But somehow Cleason's charm and lies helped him slip through the tiniest cracks one more time. So once Cleason is able to start stockpiling weapons again, Marie said his whole demeanor changed. And it was like he became a completely different person. He was obsessive, violent, easy to anger, paranoid, and worst of all, physically abusive to Marie.
Oh no.
He filled some rooms of Marie's home with so many guns that they filled entire rooms. And boxes of ammo and magazines. He hid armaments in the walls and the false roof of their home. And we're talking about like fully automatic assault rifles, tables for manufacturing ammo, sniper rifles, and even illegal modifications like silencers. When cleaning his guns, Cleason would sometimes aim them menacingly at Marie's head, much like he had his terrified victims on the homemade shooting range back in Texas. He would even threaten Marie further with the weapons on occasion, saying things like, quote, "Do what I say or I will shoot you in the face."
Oh my God.
Yeah. Marie came to understand she had made a horrible mistake. However, she put up with Cleason's abuse on the grounds that she was a devout Christian, believing that this was part of God's plan and that she had to deal with the consequences of her decision.
Oh, Marie.
Yeah.
Well, God doesn't want you to live with a maniac abuser. That's
how I feel.
Poor honey.
One night, Marie's nightmare got even worse, though. And this is when Cleason became upset at something that they were discussing and began beating her about the face viciously.
Oh.
A close friend of Marie's said that she was beaten so badly that she couldn't leave the house for a fortnight, which is 2 weeks, because of the bruising in her eyes and her face. She was forced by Cleason to call up friends and break plans and stay at home to let her wounds heal. After the beating, Marie took most of her things and she moved into the back room of the house, basically hiding herself away from Cleason during most of the day. She did that for years.
Oh, no.
Yeah. While Marie was hiding herself away from her husband as much as possible, other people around Barton Upton Humber began noticing a change in Cleason as well. Since becoming a successful gun dealer in the area, friends and associates and various hunting and gun clubs said that the man began to show his darker side. One person noted that Cleason could flip like a switch, turn into a crazed monster, and contort his face into a demon. Others simply stated to them, he was odd Bob. He was full of weird stories, and if you questioned him about it, he'd get really upset. He was just odd. In late 1993, Cleason's behavior exploded at a usual waterfowl hunting spot when Cleason threatened a man with a shotgun to the face who had simply questioned the way that Cleason had parked his car. Word began to spread around town that odd Bob was in fact a hair-trigger maniac, and this case went to court, and shockingly, because he's friends with the police, both men ended up getting fined.
Wow. Jeez, man.
Yeah. While no police action was taken to remove Cleason's gun dealing license, his fellow gun club associates took notice. A few of them started doing their own background checks to find out who this Mad Yank was. And that's one of the names somebody called him in the documentary. Oh, he's a Mad Yank. Well, that was Australian. Oh, he's a Mad Yank.
There you go. Yeah. I love it.
Well, the gun shop owner, Tony Fox, had always had a distaste for Robert Gleason. Even if he couldn't quite put his finger on it, with concern now on his mind after the recent events and being a friend of the family, he started writing to different departments of the military and other organizations that would take his letters to try and confirm some of Cleason's stories about his military honors.
Good guy.
Yeah. In 1999, Fox faxed a letter to the Medal of Honor Society in America asking for proof and registries of Cleason's decorations. He listed off everything Cleason had said, sent it over. The society wrote back and confirmed Fox's worst suspicions. Cleason not only had never received any military decoration, he had never been in the military at all. Fox turned the information over to the local authorities, and they began their own investigation into Robert Cleason and who he really was.
Oh.
They actually filed a formal inquiry to Interpol, showing them what they had discovered. And Interpol took over at that point, and they returned information back to the magistrates on Cleason and his American offenses. They found information about all of his gun violations and his assault charges, including shooting a man's toe off. But somehow they missed Cleason's involvement in the two missing Mormon missionaries.
What?
Yeah, they missed
it. I mean, he served time related to those cases.
Somehow they missed it. Even so, local police moved in and raided Marie's house. This was enough. So they moved in on the cottage. And especially because there were gun violations. That's what they were most worried about, since he's a gun dealer in the UK. For 5 hours, Cleason cried and wailed in front of the police as they searched the home, removing every firearm and bullet that they could find. Marie told a close friend, Liz Butterfield. First of all, I love Liz Butterfield's name. And she's a sweetheart and an angel in the documentary. And I love her. She's awesome. That she's totally worth watching the whole documentary. She told Liz Butterfield that Cleason cried in his room for weeks after the police left, taking all of his, quote, children. Yes, that's how he constantly referred to his guns.
Ew.
His dealing and possession license for firearms had both been voided as well. This only drove Cleason into a deeper paranoia and a madness. He began hiding large knives and blades all over the home, and he started telling Marie that he had to do this because, quote, they can come for me at any time. And when she would ask, who's they, he would get upset, like, how dare you not know who they are? It's Nazis who fled to South America, who, like, I have information on. It's the CIA who's mad at me for leaving. It's the FBI. It's Interpol.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, at first I was going to say that I thought that them taking away all of his firearms is a good thing because at least Marie knows that he no longer has access to them. But at the same time, that's now fueled his paranoia and his rage and his violence.
Stripped all of his power away, too, and left him naked like a babe. And you can also see at this point the ramp up again. Like you could see before, mm-hmm. like when he was about to go to jail and face charges, there was a ramp up phase where his mind broke and finally all these lies ruined him. Well, that's happening again. He's starting the ramp up again. Marie also took alarm at Cleason moving a large bandsaw into the cottage and telling her it was for chopping up wood. He put it in the kitchen, by the way. She didn't believe him, much like you and I don't. And she didn't even know about this other stuff. She was just like, that's messed up. We don't need a bandsaw in the kitchen. And she told her friend Liz Butterfield about this. And Liz gets freaked out. She's very alarmed. And she asked her son to use the computer to look up stuff about Cleason's background. It was only then that the true nature of Cleason's history and the potential for violence was revealed. A simple search on a couple of databases and a couple of search engines started bringing up articles about these missing Mormons in Texas. Liz's son, he was shocked when he started seeing it. Like, he didn't even believe it at first. This is like a guy he's gone fishing with, has shown him how to shoot a gun. And he shows his mom, Liz, and she freaks out. And she goes, okay, look, I've got to get over to Marie's house and I got to show her this. She basically sets up a time for her to meet. And they go and they meet in public. And she shows her all this stuff. And she said she went white as a sheet. And she was like, you know, you always hear people say that, but she was, this is the one and only time I've ever seen it actually happen. And obviously there was some shock and denial at first, but eventually Marie decided she would figure out a way to escape before Cleason had a chance to use that bandsaw table for her. One morning, the two older women in bad health with arthritis and assisted by canes and each other, began moving small shopping bags of what appeared like rubbish for a charity sale that Liz had been helping with, and Marie had agreed to put in some stuff from the attic. Those were actually her belongings, and they shuffled them into the car real quick and got out of there before Robert could do anything.
Yes!
Yeah, like these, I love the idea of like these two elderly ladies with canes. Oh, just going to the charity thing! See you later, Rob! Fuck you! Liz is great. I'm telling you, the whole documentary is worth it just for her. They got into Liz's car and Liz sped off, and she didn't give Robert time to get into his vehicle and chase after them. And she immediately started taking hairpin turns and going down back alleys and like weird roads. Liz. Yeah, she went out on country roads that were just two dirt tracks that she knew about from being a kid, and whisked her across the countryside and got her to a safe house that had already been predetermined.
Yes. Oh, what a good friend.
And Marie stayed there for like the next 5 days. So here's the genius of what Marie and Liz did, though. And they weren't intending on this, but this is like an extra bonus effect. Since they had let no one know their plan, everyone starts looking for Marie. And all of her other friends and associates start going like, where's Marie been? Why is she around? Where's she been all week? It's a work week. Robert Gleason doesn't have any answers for those people.
Yeah.
So friends and family start getting like really concerned, and they file a missing persons report for Marie. Because they're worried about her safety. They've heard her mention in quiet rooms that she's worried about her husband and he might do something to her. They're thinking he killed her. So the police show up. They see a bandsaw in the kitchen. They see knives taped to all the furniture around the house. He's ranting and raving about they're coming to take him because his knowledge about war crimes. They think he's already killed her.
Wow.
Yeah. And so they pick him up and they take him down to the station. They also raid the house again, searching for any clues to what happened to Marie. Well, in this raid, the police again find two pistols inside. These were acquired illegally, and one was described as an assassin's pistol with a silencer on it. When questioned at the station about the nature of this gun, Gleason claimed the weapon was his personal firearm when he was an agent for the CIA, and he didn't want to hand it over the first search, because it was so sentimental to him and all the kills that he had with that pistol. And of course, this was all not even close to the truth. It was just another odd Bob story. Well, in March of 2000, Gleason was charged with illegally possessing guns once again. But this time, he had so many friends in law enforcement that he was actually put on a special parole for health reasons. And he was old and he had to be in a wheelchair and all this stuff, which was another ruse of his.
Well, isn't Marie still missing at this point?
No, she's found 5 days later. So like at this point, Marie has been located at the safe house, but she's not going home because Robert is back out on parole now. And where does he go? Back to Marie's house.
Of course.
Yeah. He's back at Marie's house. He's waiting for his trial to start. And this is the last hurrah for Robert Gleason, because he pulls what I like to refer to as the old Gleason trick. And what's that, Aaron? What do you think that is?
I don't know.
What's when you pen pal a woman in another country and you set up a trip to the for a holiday and you get another marriage arranged, right?
What?
Yeah, he's got another woman in Germany that he's been writing for weeks now, knowing that this time was going to come. That he's already set up everything. He's got a storage locker at the docks loaded up with furniture, supplies, ready to go on the next ferry. And he shuffles his butt down to the ferry, thinking he's going to get onto this ferry and make off to Germany before he can be charged. Unfortunately for him, the police, they gave him a little leeway because they knew him. But there were a couple of like magistrates who did not trust this guy and they thought he was a flight risk. They arrested his ass at that dock.
Good.
They got him again, and they got him on worse charges because he's trying to flee the illegal gun charges. He ends up serving 3 years in Belmarsh prison for illegal gun charges and fleeing for charged crimes. He served that sentence quietly, but this time he wasn't released when his time was up. Because that long arm of the Texas lawman came reaching over the pond to snatch him back to prison here in the States.
Really?
Yeah. See, what was going on back in the States was, is they reopened that murder case into Mark Fisher, and the Texas prosecutors had found new evidence that they had overlooked the first time around back in the 70s and 80s. They found that there were workers' overalls, like coveralls, basically, that belonged to Gleason that were just kind of pushed and discarded into a barrel on the property. They had blood and hair on them. And since the search warrant for the taxidermy shop, like we were talking about before, included the grounds and the property in and around the shop, the coveralls and the barrel were fair game to be retested. Well, it's good that they did, because those coveralls, they had Mark's DNA on it, they had Gary's DNA on it, and they had hair from both of them on it. And they also had blood from where Robert Cleason cut himself on the coveralls.
Yes.
It's the smoking gun in this case, right? The case was officially reopened, and a request for extradition was sent to the courts in the UK. Sometimes these requests can take years, but Texas prosecutors said they were eager to retry this case, even going as far to say, quote, "Texas has a score to settle with Robert Cleason." Of course, they could no longer ask for the death penalty due to the extradition restrictions from the UK.
Yeah.
But they figured life in prison at his age, that was good enough. Mm-hmm. They wanted justice. On April 21st, 2003, before the extradition papers could be reviewed and granted, Robert Cleason pulled one final Cleason. He just disappeared as he died in prison from apparent heart failure.
No.
He was 69 years old. He had a massive heart attack and died.
That is so frustrating.
Yep. The aftermath wasn't cool either, because, you know, Barton Upton Humber, it pretty much returned back to what it was before the arrival of the Mad Yank and Ob Bob. But a decade of wounds and the horrors of abuse that Marie Longley suffered from, those took their toll. And after finally moving back into her cottage, she mostly kept to herself and close friends such as Liz Butterfield. And Liz said in the documentary that it's really sad because Marie just keeps to herself and she's lost that vivacious life that she had to her.
Aww.
I know. On another note, 25 years after her son's death, Kathy Fisher said in an article regarding the death of Cleason at the time that it brought no comfort to her. And this is the article from the Utah paper that I mentioned at the beginning of the episode. And inside she says, quote, "We won't have another trial hanging over our heads. That's good. But there won't be any difference as far as closure is concerned. Only if he told us what happened to Mark's body. That part is not closed. I guess the whole world is a safer place. There's that, I suppose." End quote. Robert Cleason's body was cremated and discarded by the Etham Cemetery and Crematorium as requested by his next of kin.
Discarded?
That's what it says about his remains, that he was cremated and discarded.
Did they flush him down the toilet where he belonged?
I hope so, but how fitting of an end to Robert Cleason is that? Like, how he discarded Mark and Gary's remains into the animal remains pile at the taxidermy shop? That's what he deserved. And that, my friends, is the tale of the real Texas Chainsaw Murderer, with an asterisk, because he's not the real Texas Chainsaw Murderer.
That was probably one of my favorite episodes that we've ever done on the show. That was a roller coaster ride.
Isn't it?
It was incredible.
And I don't care if it's a long episode, because it needs to be told.
It was also, I believe, the first time All Crime No Cattle has gone international.
Yeah, we have a couple other cases I'm researching currently that have some international stuff, and one of them involves Texas Rangers abroad, which I really want to do that
case.
That's
exciting.
But yeah, it was fun to go to jolly old England.
Man, what a piece of garbage. That really that is especially sad, like you were saying, for Gary's family, who, no, he was never tried for Gary's death at all.
Yeah.
And that's really sad. And both of those families, like they were saying, neither one of those families was able to bury their missing loved one. They never knew what happened to those bodies. I mean, that's...
Yeah, it sucks. It sucks to not have like a official finality conclusion that's written down in stone as this is what we think happened.
Yeah.
But I think we all kind of know.
Oh, of course.
What happened.
And again, thank God for DNA, because... Yeah.
Then those people wouldn't have any of that resolution. Like, if he'd have died before the case was even ever reopened, they never would have done anything with it.
Yeah, it's interesting, those cases that are always before DNA, and they have to rely on things like blood typing and comparing hair follicles and just stuff that's just not very concrete.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, you know, cases are tried all the time that don't have DNA, but it's really nice when you have DNA and it's just so solid like this.
And that's why, like, forensic psychologists and FBI analysts who've looked into Robert Cleason, That's why they believe he could have possibly killed a lot of other people across the country during this time period because of the nature of his crimes and because he clearly has social behavioral disorder. They think it leads into that kind of a direction, and they think he definitely fits into a possible serial killer mm-hmm. who could have killed a lot more people across the country. He was a vagabond. He was a roamer, you know? He was a traveling killer.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if he did kill more people. Yeah, wow. That was very interesting. I don't believe I've ever heard the full details of that story.
I've heard of the Mormon missionary murders case before, but I'd never heard about his travels to the UK. I'd never heard about Marie Longley. We say this all the time, and that's why you have to sit down and do this kind of research and delve into these cases like this, is because then you get the whole story. Yeah. And you get to see it from start to finish. You don't get just a little blip. So I guess the last thing that I wanted to say about this case was, you know, this happened in a really terrible time period for Austin. Just a year before this, they had a horrible case where a guy went to an ice cream parlor and killed a bunch of people. And then there was another case where a father killed a family of eight with knives. Then, there was Charles Whitman and the Tower shooting. It was just year after year, everything that could go wrong was going wrong in Austin. And that kind of played a role in the minds of students who were writing and directing the Texas Chainsaw Massacre film that was released just before Robert Gleason got to town.
Yeah.
So in a way, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, he's not the reason and the impetus for the film, but it does have a very Texas connection with this crime. And it's not just arbitrary, but it still doesn't make sense for a killer's nickname.
Well, it makes sense why the media mm-hmm. and, you know, people like that would make those connections, especially if the movie had just come out. And especially, like you were saying, if it sweeps week, people want the ratings up. And what better way to do that than to connect a double homicide to, you know, one of the biggest, goriest horror movies that just came out. So
you're exactly right. Anyways, it was fun and sad, but fun. I hope you enjoyed the ride. But now I think it's time for a little good news, Aaron.
I think so, too. I've got a good one for you, too.
All right, we'll be right back after this.
Well, our good news story this week comes from ABC 13 News, and this is about a family from the Katy, Texas area. This is the Johansson family. Mom Tracy, oldest brother Aiden, who is 15, Luke, who is 13, and George, who is 11.
And Katy's just west of Houston, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Okay. Luke, who is the middle son, loves rhinoceroses.
Who doesn't?
Real, you know, obsession, real passion for them and for rhino conservation, which is, I think, a really cool thing for a kid his age to be interested in. So for the last several years, every time it's his birthday, he actually does a little bit of a birthday fundraiser. And so he gets all, you know, his family and friends or whatever to donate to certain rhino nonprofit organizations that help with rhino conservation. So it's something that's been just a lifelong love for him, which is super sweet and adorable. So already that's kind of a cute story.
Yeah, some people do that on Facebook where you can donate for the birthday.
Yeah.
But he's doing it in real life.
Yeah, exactly. Meanwhile, the mom, Tracy, she has her own little hobby that she's really interested in, and that's making her own homemade salsa. This is a creamy cilantro verde salsa, which sounds very interesting. I'm down. You know us Texans, we love our salsa.
You had me at salsa.
Exactly. And this is something that Tracy would make for teachers and neighbors and family members and everything for the holidays. So this is something that she would give out a lot. Everybody loves her salsa.
I bet it's good.
It sounds really amazing. I will go to town on some salsa, that's for sure. Well, they came up with the idea, you know, we've been doing these fundraisers for rhinoceros conservation. Why don't we take it a step further? Really kind of focus on this salsa as a business and then contribute some of the proceeds to this business to rhino conservation. And that's exactly what they've done.
That's amazing.
So they turned Tracy's salsa recipe into Diablo Verde salsa. And it's really cool. Like the label of it, it's a little green devil.
Oh, okay.
And it's Diablo Verde. And they have gotten this salsa. They've sold it at farmers markets. They've actually now been incorporated into local business stores in Katy, in that area, but also actually across Texas now.
Yeah, it's like when you see local salsas in like a Kroger or something.
Yes. And if you know, if you're from Texas, you definitely know that those are the brands you go for. Oh, if you have to go to a grocery store
and
buy salsa as opposed to homemade salsa, which is always the best. But you always get the small brand. You don't go for paste picante sauce, okay, guys? You go for like a small kind of homemade style salsa.
I want Doritos, the chip, not the sauce that they've figured out how to concoct.
Exactly. Because it's never good.
I'll take a local sauce over that any day.
Exactly. So this is, I'm going to look for this next time I go to the grocery store.
Sounds like a plan.
And so this whole family, it's like a family-owned operation. They get into their kitchen and they make huge batches of this particular Verde salsa. And they're selling it now across the state of Texas. Part of the proceeds of the selling of this salsa actually go to the nonprofit called the International Rhino Foundation. And this is a foundation that does rhino conservation and also anti-poaching activities throughout Africa.
Oh, how poignant. We had poaching in our episode today.
I know. Isn't that weird? And they actually got connected to this foundation through the Houston Zoo. So basically, they contacted the Houston Zoo when they said, what's the best organization that we can give our money to that is actually out there and active in the world and doing good? What's the best thing that we can do for rhinoceroses? And that's where they pointed them to, the International Rhino Foundation. So a part of the proceeds for every jar of salsa they sell go to the International Rhino Foundation. It's just a pretty incredible story.
That's amazing.
That's super amazing. What a wonderful thing for a family to do.
I love rhinos and salsa. I am so down for this.
I am too. And like I said, it is Diablo Verde salsa. I'm going to be looking for it. I hope I can find it somewhere.
Yeah, and you should too, listeners.
We
know a bunch of you are in Texas.
Yeah, definitely go check out their salsa.
Help a rhino.
And exactly, you could help out rhinos.
In certain parts of the world. I was gonna say all over the world, but there's no rhinos in Alaska.
Wild Texas rhinos. But yeah, a really good story. It's really nice to know people, you know, putting their minds to making a difference like that. So I thought it was very sweet.
Definitely. Salsa and rhinos. Let's do it.
Nom 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 nom.
And now we jump to the next part of the show, which is recommendations. And this week, we're coming at you with the second delivery of a podcast that we've talked about before. We haven't ever played a promo for this podcast, but we've done an interview with a concerned citizen from Swindled. Remember that, Aaron?
I do. I do recall.
We are one of the few people who have met the concerned citizen in the flesh.
Oh, yes.
And we have signed memorabilia.
We were blown away
by
his charisma, uniqueness, nerve, and talent.
No, we're good friends with the host of Swindled, and he does keep kind of an enigmatic persona about him, but it kind of fits with his show's mystique.
Mm-hmm.
And so what his show is he follows various cases of white-collar crime from all over the country and the world. And yours truly has been on an episode of Swindled.
You sure have.
Playing Sexy Putin. So, yeah. Go check that out if you haven't heard that episode. It's an episode about the World Cup and all the FIFA scandal. But man, he covers topics like if you can't find something that Swindled's covered that you're not into, who are you? Because he does such interesting cases in totally different genres like every week.
Mm-hmm.
If there's a corporate scandal to be had in that particular realm, he'll go find it. And that's what I love about his show. It's really well produced. He's got a great voice. He does really neat music and soundscapes like underneath his show. And his new season, season 2, just debuted with the first episode, The Canoe Man, The Disappearance of John Darwin. It's a great episode. He did great work on this one, as usual. And he's got all these cool little icons that he puts out for every episode, where each episode has a different little stick figure guy. And it becomes part of the overall Swindled scape. And they have like horns and devil tails, each one of them.
Yeah, it's such a cool show and it's such a unique perspective on true crime. I mean, you don't really get this. You don't really get these stories anywhere else.
Yep.
And I think it's really important for us to be aware of stories like this going down internationally, because oftentimes we don't hear about things like this. And it's important as consumers, as just everyday citizens, being aware of all of the horrible things that corporations and people in power do.
Yeah. Most of the time on our show, we're covering the little guy.
Yeah.
The little cases of the common man.
But this is the big guy who's screwing over the little guy real bad. Just a very important show. And of course, we're friends with a concerned citizen. We love him and we love his show. So please go check it out. You probably already have. I mean, we're preaching to the choir over here.
Yeah. So listen to that trailer right now. Literally.
For over 40 years, Hooker Chemical Corporation dumped over 80 toxic substances at Love Connect.
There is substantial medical opinion that continued use of the Dalkon Shield may pose a serious personal health hazard.
Oh, I hate all of you! I hate you!
He's accused of orchestrating the largest lotto scam ever.
In opening arguments, prosecutor Jerry Miller portrayed Baker as a greedy, money-hungry showman who practiced fraud disguised as religion.
Martin Shkreli has become the most hated man in America.
My kid's not here. He's dead. Because of him. He ruined my life.
Swindled is a podcast that uses narrative storytelling, archival audio, and immersive soundscapes to explore true cases of white-collar crime and corporate greed. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever else you may get your podcasts. For more information about the show, visit our website at swindledpodcasts.com.
Okay, guys, and we're back with the after show.
After show.
And just a quick plug for all of our various things. You can find us on Twitter at ACNC Podcast, on Instagram at All Crime No Cattle. You can send us an email at allcrimenocattle@gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook and iTunes. And what we've been doing is, if you've given us a 5-star review on either one of those places, we will read your review on the air. That's going to be slowing down, I think, within the next couple of days, is what we announced last week.
Yep.
Because we are then transitioning to reading people's Patreon stuff.
Yeah.
Which is a good segue to the fact that we have a Patreon now.
That's right. So if you go to Patreon and you search All Crime No Cattle, you'll find our Patreon page. And Aaron and I have been working really hard on it. There's a lot of really cool tiers to it. We think that it offers a lot of really neat options for you guys, like enamel pins with our logo on it, buttons, shout outs,
ad-free listening.
Yeah, everybody loves ad-free listening. Live Q&As with us, bonus
extra
content.
Episodes. Yes.
Yeah.
So hopefully it's good stuff that you guys are interested in. Go check that out for more info.
Yeah. You can find more of our merch over at allcrimenocattle.threadless.com.
Yes.
Yeah, we just gave a bunch of it away for the big contest, and hopefully you really enjoy it. Well, on to the reviews, Aaron.
Yes. So let's start out on iTunes. This is by Teenage Toto. And they say, Texas Slave Ranch. Great podcast. Please do an episode on the Texas Slave Ranch.
Very direct. Cutting out the fat, getting straight to the meat.
That's right. Teenage Toto, you will be happy to know that we are definitely planning to cover the Texas Slave Ranch.
Yeah.
The next one comes from RG1376, who says, wonderful. Y'all two are hilarious. I really like the show, and this is my favorite Texas true crime podcast. It's well-researched and presented. I can't stop listening. You should throw your backup staff a bone. Yeah, we don't have backup staff. What is that? Joke's on us, because every single part of this podcast is created, maintained, thought of, and slaved over by yours truly, Shay and Aaron.
Yep.
That's it.
The dogs don't help. They're working on their own show, Snuggles
We've
and Snacks.
We've been trying to get them to do anything around here. They won't even wash a dish, guys.
Yep.
That's how lazy they are. But I appreciate that you think we have backup staff. Thank you.
If more people donate to the Patreon, that's something that the show can afford.
Oh, God, that would be so lovely, too, wouldn't it?
Hire research assistants.
All right, the next one comes from Cassie Lovegram, and they say, clearly y'all from Dallas, but hello, Houston is where it's at. Nice show, though, by the way.
Also, you're blatantly wrong again. How many times do we have to say this?
Yeah.
We're not from Dallas.
We're not.
Dallas and Fort Worth are different places.
We've never even lived in Dallas.
I feel like at this point, Houston has a running joke to send us reviews
saying that we're from Dallas. Dallas. I think so. It is some kind of Houston conspiracy. Murder City, are you behind this? I'm looking at you guys. The next one is a friend of our show, Affirmative Murder Podcast. If you haven't listened to Affirmative Murder, you should go do that. They're a really great podcast, really great people, and they're on our network on Murderly.
Well, go check out Alvin Williams and his partner. They do Affirmative Murder, and it's true crime involving people of color.
Yeah, it's a really great show, and I really like their cereal?
Oh, yeah, where they watch a TV show and eat cereal.
Yeah, it's pretty
great. And talk about it.
But they say, I'm only leaving 5 stars because I can't leave 6. This podcast is just objectively amazing from a true crime standpoint. Lovable hosts, Aaron and Shay, awesomely researched, perfectly sound. Thank you.
Oh, man.
Affirmative Murder. You guys are lovely.
You're classy, Alvin. I like you.
And the last one from iTunes comes from Kai's Moms. Kiz Moms. I don't know. But they say, love. I love this podcast. I love true crime podcasts, but this one takes the cake. Born and raised in Texas, I've been to the most, if not all, of these cities, so this is really interesting to me. Love, love it. Thank you, Kiz Moms. We appreciate it.
All right, moving over to the Facebook reviews. We got Amy Celto Bellamy coming at you, giving us 5 stars and just peacing out. Thank you. Drive by five. Joe Delias Packwood says 5 stars, intellect, style, and charisma. All crab, no cattle.
It sounds like RuPaul's Drag Race, charisma, uniqueness, nerve, and talent.
I feel like we have all those things.
I agree.
Marty Henson says, you have listened to the others. Now listen to the best true crime podcast out there. I love me some All Crime, No Cattle. Aaron and Shay blend so well on this podcast. I just found All Crime, No Cattle about 2 weeks ago, and I'm trying to finish the Murderly Mashup episode. Aaron and Shay's voices blend so well, and the banter seems real.
It seems real. we script all our banter. Yeah. It's a show secret.
And the real is in all caps. Seems real. Not contrite like some other podcasts I've listened to before. ACNC researches to a level that you will not believe. ACNC has outstanding sound quality, way above the average podcast. The professional podcasts are the only ones I have found that compare to ACNC. Whoop, Shay, since you are the sound guy. Boom, boom, boom. Looking at the love. I love it. Erin is amazing in her own right. You can feel the emotion in her voice as she tells the story or interacts with Shay. Shay is no less into telling the story and ensures that the listener is informed of his feelings about any abuse or murder. I wish I could have more. All crime, no cattle. Once a week is not enough. Love me some ACNC.
Well, thank you. That is very nice and lovely and sweet.
Yeah. That is really thorough.
It was a lot of information. My cheeks are flushed.
Yeah, we're making that blush emoji right now. Amelia Hackett says, wonderful podcast. I accidentally came across it and liked it immediately. Perfect for true crime fans everywhere.
Oh, very nice. Thank you. Glad you're here.
And last one is from Jen Herringdine. What started as an innocent 1 hour a day habit has morphed into an addiction that some days borders on shamefulness. True crime podcasts accompany me for hours and hours of my day, through the commutes, the chores, and the city walks with my pups. While there are many true crime podcasts that I enjoy, All Crime No Cattle has quickly climbed up the ranks and become one of my favorites. From the thorough research done for each episode and to the rapport between Aaron and Shay, to respect for the victims and the good news segment, All Crime No Cattle is a top-notch podcast. Doesn't hurt that I live in San Antonio for 2 years. Great quality content, 5 stars for sure. Abrazos from Bogota, Colombia.
Oh, Bogota is the capital city of Colombia. I know that from 8th grade Spanish class.
Oh,
Bogota, Colombia.
I knew that from watching Narcos.
Oh, okay. Well, that's different. But thank you. That's very sweet. And that's awesome. So she or he, I don't know who this person is.
She, Jen.
But they lived in San Antonio and now they live in Colombia, huh? Interesting. Say hello to Shakira.
She from Colombia?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, cool.
Hey, how many times how many times have we mentioned Shakira on this show?
I don't know, but them hips don't lie. Okay, that's the show, guys. We gotta get out of here. This is a long episode, but I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you stuck with it. And, you know, next week is birthday girl time. I hope
I have to do an episode on my birthday.
Hey, I did it too. I said sad. I wasn't going to do it, and then I did it for the love of our fans. Because that's how much we love you guys. And in return, I expect you to send Aaron all the craziest birthday gifts. That is G-I-F-S. There's no T. I don't want you to send her a gift.
No,
I
mean, you can send me a gift too.
But I'm not requesting that. I'm asking for goofy things sent to the Facebook page and the Twitter account.
Okay.
That's what I want. Wish her a happy birthday across the internet. Boom. We'll see you next time. You know what we always say. Crime is bigger in Texas, y'all. Adios.
Bye.